This is Tofu Dave with another edition of Between the Covers, a literature quickie on your community radio station. Today I'm talking to Augustine Sedgwick, the author of Coffeeland, One Man's Dark Empire, and the Making of Our Favorite Drug. Hello, Augustine. How are you today?
Hi, Dave. I'm pretty well. How are you?
Well, I'm good. And of course, as is most of the case on these interviews, I'm sitting here with my Fair Trade San Ramon, Nicaragua, Sister City, black coffee. I hope that doesn't disturb you.
You're caffeinated and you're doing it the right way. Good to hear.
Ready to go. Listen, your book is really interesting, Coffeeland. I actually read it cover to cover.
Oh, thank you, Dick.
I was a little surprised when I first opened the book. You begin the book with a quote from Martin Luther King, which I was not expecting at all, in which he points out some of our morning rituals and I guess the States and where things come from, and he ends it with, before you finish eating breakfast in the morning, you've depended on more than half the world. Was that sort of the motivation for your writing this book, to explain those connections?
To explore those connections, absolutely. Explaining them is probably beyond my powers of explanation. And the truth is, one of the things I think about is, one of the things that I love about that quotation from King is explaining those connections, but also in a sense beyond King's powers, much more considerable powers of explanation. It's often forgotten that during the last year of his life, his most ambitious project was this attempt to develop a new language and morality of global connection and global interdependence. And the quotation that I use as an epigraph for the book is simply one draft of his attempts to do so in 1967, 1968.
Well, so true. And I share with you an interest in the history of Central America. Of course, coffee is grown in many parts of the world. There are endless arguments about where the best tasting coffee comes from, of course, but you ended up focusing on El Salvador, partly because, I guess, of personal connections, but you also found a family called the Hill family who were immigrants to El Salvador, I guess it was in the 1800s, from Manchester, England, and you used them to center your story, the history of El Salvador and the history of this family. And I'm leading into, since we are doing our quickie book interview here, to sort of one of the hearts of your arguments was the sad transformation, I guess I would put it, and I'm interpreting now, I'm going to ask for your input, of coffee cultivation around the world from a sort of a multi-culture where people could grow food to eat alongside of where they lived into what's often called a monoculture where, especially in your history of El Salvador, coffee crops in the plantation system stripped people of the ability to grow their own food. Did I get it right?
Right. I think you could actually put it a little more strongly than that, in that the key to making coffee production profitable in El Salvador was hunger. Was the transformation of lands that had been used to produce a variety of crops, precisely as you said, including food crops, into land where no food grew at all. And that wasn't only about eliminating those other ways of using the land, but also about eliminating food sources that thrived within, coffee plantations, fruit trees that were used as shade, bean plants that returned nitrogen to the soil, animals that lived among the coffee. All sources of food were eliminated from those plantations in order to require the Salvadorans to work coffee if they wanted to eat.
And essentially it was really to maximize profits, I guess. There's no other way to put it, because the drive on those that owned the plantations was to maximize the monetary return for their family at all costs.
Productivity, absolutely. They, you know, the truth is that profits, to some extent, are out of the hands of coffee growers. They depend on the fluctuations of an international coffee market that is up and down, especially in the first half of the 20th century, was violently and wildly up and down. Mm-hmm. The one thing that coffee planters could control, to some extent, was what it cost for them to produce the thing and how much of it they could produce. And the key to controlling that aspect of the coffee economy was making sure that anyone who wanted to eat had to go through them to do so.
And you recount some very moving things in your book. I don't want to give away some of the story of the central character and what happens with the Hill family as the descendants come into being and grow up and realize what their history is. But you also recounted a very terrifying, to me, massacre of the indigenous population, I believe, in the early 1930s as the coffee workers started to fight for their rights. And
yes,
somebody you quoted talked about it. I may have the exact words incorrect, but the sensibility was there are no more Indians in El Salvador, colloquial for indigenous people. And it seemed to go back to that time in the early 30s when the Salvadoran oligarchy basically exterminated just thousands of indigenous people in El Salvador.
Right. That was the word that observers used at the time. In the worst years of the Great Depression, 1931, 1932, people who had worked coffee in El Salvador, thousands of people who had worked coffee in El Salvador, joined with union organizers, including some members of the Communist Party, in an effort to retake the land that had been theirs and begin to use it again in ways that they thought were most appropriate to their needs. The response of the Salvadoran government in alliance with the coffee planters was to undertake a genocidal massacre that killed thousands upon thousands, if not 10,000 of Salvadorans. And the effects of that are still felt very strongly in the country, in its politics and economy today.
Yes, I think it is. And, as we come to a close, Augustine, with your book, discussing your book, Coffee Land, One Man's Dark Empire and the Making of Our Favorite Drug. Let's bring it up to today. Here I am sitting drinking my Nicaraguan fair trade coffee, and you make a compelling argument towards the end of your book that we ought to, as coffee consumers and producers, I guess, look towards ending the monoculture of coffee. And you criticize the fair trade movement and you propose a different view of how coffee could be grown. As we close off on the discussion of your book, Coffee Land, Augustine Sedgwick, could you tell us what we see for the future if we want to make drinking and producing coffee fairer and better?
Right. Well, the most encouraging thing in the book possibly is the idea that the Specialty Coffee Association of America is now arguing for coffees to be certified, or is now proposing that coffees be certified as quote-unquote food security or food sovereignty coffees. And what that means is that hunger would no longer be used as a factor in the production of those coffees. And considering the transformation of vast stretches of the planet into coffee monocultures in the interest of coffee businesses and drinkers far away, the strongest countermeasure could be the idea that people would no longer have to work coffee simply in order to eat and to survive, but that they could eat and survive and then work coffee on those terms.
Great. That is a great point. I urge everybody to Abacot and Reed Coffee Land by Augustine Sedgwick. Thank you so much, Augustine, for taking the time to chat with us today on Community Radio, Between the Covers, another literature group.